Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and you've just got me today. Caroline's not with us today, but she is still doing fine. I know some of you are always concerned to hear about her because she is at 85, one of our at-risk, part of our at-risk population for COVID, for sure. But she's healthy and strong. So we have a really fun book to introduce to you today and a really interesting guest, Lori Goldstein, who earned her BA in journalism but eventually found her true writing passion in the world of fiction. She's never met a beach she didn't love, a book she wouldn't read, or a strange food she wouldn't try. She's the author of Sources Say, which is the book that we are talking about today. It's a book for young adults, and she is also the writer of Screen Queens and the contemporary fantasy series Becoming Jin. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Lori.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. And did I get your name pronounced correctly?
Absolutely.
All right. Very good. So tell us a little bit about Sources Say. It's kind of an interesting concept.
Yes, so it's definitely a one for our current time.
Yes.
It weaves themes of journalism and the media and political candidates, so very timely for a fall 2020 release book. But even though it has these kind of bigger ideas and very timely topics, my books always feel to me mostly about family, mostly about a mother-daughter, and in this case, it's sisters. So as much as it is about big topics, it really is how they affect the people, the characters that are kind of the most important part of any story that I hope to put on the page. And Sources Say, so is about two sisters, Kat and Angeline, and they're entering their senior year of high school in two very different places. Kat is this kind of old school journalist, determined to elevate her newspaper that's been struggling, and she wants to be able to win an award to impress the admissions board at Northwestern, where she hopes to go to college. And her sister, Angeline, is the complete opposite. She's an up-and-coming YouTube star, a wannabe influencer, and she was just invited to this boot camp run by a mega influencer that Angeline thinks will really make her career. But Angeline's mom isn't convinced, and she'll only let Angeline attend this boot camp if she gets more serious about school. That's how Angeline winds up running for student council president, and how her sister Kat is forced to cover her sister's campaign as part of the newspaper. And this is problematic for Kat because they're not that close. After their dad left them, they're raised by their single mom and their grandfather, the two sisters kind of have grown apart. So as the story goes on, Kat, as the journalist, is starting to battle this digital onion-like newspaper that pops up spreading fake news about the candidates. And Angeline has to tackle her very recent ex who decides to run against her in the student council election. And through kind of their storylines, the book is told in both their points of view, they start to realize that kind of both of their paths to success and figuring out exactly kind of how to deal with everything that's going on for them is to kind of concentrate on themselves, the sisters they are, the ones they hope to be. So it's definitely got a lot of timely topics, but also sisterhood, friendship, a little bit of romance, and I hope some humor in there. That's my goal.
Now, Lori, what inspired you? Was there anything specific that you saw in the news or that was going on in the world that sparked this idea of writing this story for you?
So the idea actually came about during a somewhat lively discussion or perhaps a slight argument with my teenage nephews. We were all together and we were talking about kind of the pros and cons of things like Reddit and using social media as a way to get your news. And I know you said at the introduction that I have a BA in journalism. So does my husband, who is their uncle, and actually so does their mother. We were all journalism majors. So we all kind of have this stronger viewpoint about what the news is and maybe that more traditional old school news bent. But that's not the case for teens anymore, and even for, you know, a lot of people older than teens. So it started to get me fascinated by the idea of how people are getting their news here, adults, but especially these teens who have grown up in a very different world than I did. You know, their access to information coming from sources and channels that just didn't even exist, let alone when I was young, but even like 10 years ago. And it is a double-edged sword, and it creates questions that teens don't have the tools to deal with, you know, adults either, really. You know, what sources are trustworthy? How do we determine that when, you know, a president is tweeting, when words like fake news are batted around, and it becomes difficult to figure out fact and fiction? How do teens assess these places, you know, that they're getting news? How do they understand what a source is, what's trustworthy, how to evaluate that, and how to make their own decisions about things? And I think that's very important going forward.
Oh, it sure is. And you're absolutely right. This is not a problem limited to teenagers by any means. I have a very dear friend who's kind of believing some of these conspiracy theories. And he's always been a little bit inclined to that, but he'll like send me links to videos or something, but I don't even watch them because it's almost like he believes the things that he sees on the internet from somebody whom he has no idea who they are or what their agenda really is, because they're saying that the mainstream media has this agenda. Well, everybody has an agenda, and in sources say that you're really illustrating that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very interesting. When I was doing some of the research about social media, and not just how people consume it and use it, but some of these statistics along the line of exactly what you're saying, that the more outrageous, the more baseless, the more things are shared on social media. They're, you know, retweeted or shared on Facebook at a much higher rate. Like, we've become primed to want to believe the fantastical in a way. And that is the thing that people seem to gravitate towards, regardless of the truth, regardless of where it's coming from. And I think it's interesting because I think you can see it in politically, but even in, you know, you mentioned COVID at the start, and I'm glad your mother is doing well. But even in terms of how people are approaching that and the parts of that that they, you know, either disseminate from, you know, Facebook or, you know, what they want to believe or choose to believe from what scientists are saying or, you know, the CDC. It's really something that people want to believe, kind of the more outrageous, those more conspiracy.
Right. And actually, that's one of the main things that this friend is about, the vaccines and, you know, these ideas that they were developed, that the whole thing was a way to plant tracers in us or something. I don't know. I don't know. It's sad. And it's hard to know what to do about it. And of course, the characters in sources say are running into the same, Cat runs into the same situation with this onion, like you said, onion-like paper making things up. Although the onion at least is deliberately trying to be funny and doesn't expect, you know, it's self-advertised as satire. And it's not trying to convince
the
people.
The paper.
Yeah.
Right. And the Shrieking Violet is not. And as you kind of go on, without any spoilers, but the perpetrator kind of uses that as an excuse of like, oh, well, everybody knew this was a joke. And that's not true. And I think that was part of what I was trying to get across as well, that sometimes things are disseminated and, it's like, oh, it's obvious that, you know, this is a joke or this is a parody. And it's really not a lot of times to a lot of people. But yes, the Onion is clear about what it's doing.
Yeah. And there's another site. It's a left-leaning site that I was just reading about, and I can't remember the name of it. But this guy sits in his basement and makes up stories that are anti-Democrat and pro-Trump. He just makes these things up, posts them, sees how many thousands of likes and shares he gets, and then goes in and say, ha ha, this was made up. But it doesn't, it's like the more ludicrous the things that he write are, the more shares he gets, just like you said. And even though he's doing it to try and show people you're being fooled, you really need to think about this, it doesn't seem to be working.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, as much as I wrote this book to, you know, I wanted to add to the conversation, I did want to highlight it for teenagers specifically. But there is no clear answer. You know, I don't have an answer. You know, the characters in the book come to some sort of conclusion, but there isn't a clear, how do we deal with this? And I think part of what I wanted to get across in the book is that it's not an easy solution, and it's something that everybody has to take responsibility for, both the people who are disseminating news, whether it's traditional or these non-traditional ways, but as well as the consumers. I think this is a situation where the onus has to be on those of us who are consuming news to start being more critical, analytical, and kind of let ourselves get rid of that sensationalistic bent that you know, most of us have of like, oh yes, it's easy to pay attention to, you know, the neon sign, but, you know, we have to start getting back to evaluating, you know, what truly is a true source of news, what truly is worth sharing, and kind of having the responsibility that you don't share something unless you're sure of what this is. That easy just click that social media lets us do is just very different. And I think it's taken, you know, a society as a whole to a place that we're all struggling with how to deal with it. And I love social media for certain aspects, so I don't ever want to malign it completely, but there are really bad sides that I think as a whole, we need to start grappling with and figure out how to do this moving forward in a more positive or at least productive way.
Well, that's definitely true. And I admit that sometimes I think, well, what if, you know, I'm relying on sources that I believe have credibility, because it's not just some guy sitting in their basement. It's, you know, there's an organization, there's a history, there's fact checking to some extent, I think. But what if I'm being fooled?
Right.
How do you really know?
Yeah, and it's really hard. And I think for especially for younger people, this social media and has been such a part of their lives from when they were born or when they were little. And so for them, it's, you know, maybe a different generation's Washington Post or New York Times or the Atlantic or things that you have an inherent trust for because, well, they've always been there. And for kids, it's something different. This social media has always been there. So kind of those arguments or those kind of teachings are hard to kind of hard to resonate necessarily with everyone because the context is different. And it was actually very interesting. It was last year, around this time last year, when you still could travel, I went back to Lehigh University, which is where I went to college. It was the 150th anniversary of the student newspaper, which I was an editor in chief of, and they had gathered a lot of alumni who were old editors in chief. And it was kind of fascinating to see what the new journals department is doing and how they're tackling this in a small way of obviously presenting, you know, journalists, and they want all the journalists who are in their program to be those trustworthy sources wherever they wind up in their fields. But they have the knowledge base of how to use social media kind of to their advantage, you know, in terms of the ability, when you're, you know, online, something digital that you're reading as opposed to a newspaper, having the ability to have your sources or your things you're quoting to be linked into the article you're writing. Ah. So not just presenting it, but kind of being transparent. There was very much an emphasis on teaching new student journalists the importance of transparency for this reason. So now you can click on that, you can see the sources, you can see the study that someone's citing, the expert, if you have an expert that you're quoting and they cite something, well, you include that as the link. So, you know, as I said, a little bit of the onus on consumers, but it's a benefit actually of, you know, maybe an online world that they can use that to their advantage to try to, you know, bolster, you know, people's understanding of what is to be trusted, and read those sources and decide if you're trusting that study or not.
Right. And when people talk about, you know, doing your own research, it's not just clicking on links of people, what people are saying. It is actually looking at the sources, what their credentials are. It is looking at the studies and actually reading the studies, because the headline takeaway from the study is often not what you would get out of it if you actually read it with the knowledge of what was happening, of what was going on there.
Right.
So that's what doing your own research means, going to the source materials. It doesn't mean just reading a bunch of shares of the same information over and over again, of not even exactly. Information of the same opinion, and being able to determine the difference between opinion and just and reporting, which it's not easy. And this is the first time that this has been a serious issue in our democracy, because, you know, we learned about yellow dog journalism back in the 1800s. And I think it's similar to that. Do you remember that term?
Well, it's interesting that I actually don't remember that term exactly, but I have an adult historical novel that is set in the 1800s that'll be released next year. And a lot of that focus is surrounding the election of 1800 and what the newspapers did in that day. And the newspapers in that day, you know, people don't think things could be worse than they are now, but the newspapers then were funded by the political parties, and, you know, veiled articles that were written actually, you know, by people supporting the candidates and presented as just kind of fact newspaper articles. It was even more partisan and quote unquote fake news than I think today.
Right. Well, yellow journalism was basically where there was little fact. You know, it was, the definition here. It's the use of lurid features and sensationalized news in newspaper publishing to attract readers and increase circulation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from Britannica. So, and the phrase was coined in the 1890s to describe the tactics employed in the furious competition between two New York City newspapers, The World and The Journal. So, like I said, this isn't the first time that we've been dealing with this, but the reach of it is probably greater because of social media and the internet. Now, dig into the bullying and so forth that social media also can happen. Is that, you know, I have concern for kids these days who are so impacted by social media on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
And there definitely is some of that in here, in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know kids that have experienced that?
In terms of the, you know, effect that they have by being so overly connected or...
in a way... Angeline is a little bit this way, although she's got a pretty strong sense of self, but she's very impacted by how many likes her posts get.
Right.
And mm-hmm. Although she, I don't think it's not like she's going to be depressed on a, if they aren't popular, it's that she's looking at it as this is her career and this impacts her ability to make money from doing this more than this is a reflection on who she is as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's true?
Yeah. You know, I think she is very focused. You know, Angeline, I think, is someone who is thinking 4, 5, 6, 7 steps ahead. And she ultimately wants a very successful career. And I think she is knowledgeable about the steps she's taking to get there. And also the lines she's willing to cross. And that comes back to, you know, bite her in the book and makes her think and is part of her growth arc. But she is aware of what she's doing. I don't think she is the type of character who is living, dying, breathing based on likes, for a self-esteem issue, she comes at it more like, I know this is a means to an end. And
right.
the more people right. who I have following me and liking me, that means I can get ahead in what I, you know, see forward as the career path I want. But I do think that is a perhaps, you know, I do actually know a couple of teens who do exactly what Angeline is doing, whether it's on Instagram or on as part of TikTok, that they are looking ahead. You know, there are people who are making a lot of money being influencers. There are people who are making a lot of money by playing video games. And teens see that. They watch that. I have friends who their sons are big gamers and looking at colleges. And colleges give scholarships for people who will play on their video game team.
Yeah.
Including Stanford. So I do think there is a subset of kids who are very much like Angeline and being like, I can make money off of this and I don't have to, you know, go to a 9-to-5 day job. So I think there are teens who are in Angeline's side, but and I do think there are the majority of teens who are doing that. I want more likes and it's a validation. And that is dangerous. Yeah. And I think that that is part of this that's difficult. But I think it also can be based on the friends I know who have kids in this age group. Sometimes maybe the emphasis in news or you know on shows on TV is very much on social media, and there are you know many examples of social media's negative influence on our teenagers. But even in person in school, I think is still as strong as it is, it's in terms of kind of whether it's bullying or kids trying to fit in, you know, that in-person in school pressure is still there. And then the social media is almost like bolstering that. So it's in the tandem between those two that I think is where a lot of these kids are falling. It's not just kind of getting those likes and things on social media. It's comparing themselves to whatever party that other people went to that they didn't go to, or were they included in this person's photo or tagged in that person's photo. So it's kind of that kind of combination. It's the things everyone had to deal with as teenagers in school, and now our teenagers today are dealing with those same things with the bolstering of what social media can bring to it. And it's a lot. It's overwhelming.
I agree. And I wonder if someday the kids will push back, you know,
mm-hmm.
and say, look, we're not doing this anymore. But that's wishful thinking. You're listening to Writers' Voices. And our guest today is Lori Goldstein, author of Sources Say. So are all of your books geared towards young adults?
Yes. As I said, I will have an adult historical coming out next year, but the four that I've published so far are all young adult books.
And what drew you to write for young adults?
It was a combination of what I was reading at the time and a combination of what was becoming very popular when I started writing. There was a boom in the young adult field, probably 2011. I sold my first book in 2013. At that time, we were coming off of Harry Potter and Hunger Games and Twilight, and these things had really just given such a growth to the young adult field. So, you know, it was partly a business decision. You know, writing is a business. It is an art, but it also is a business. And as I was finding out more about the industry and becoming a writer and seeing what publishers and agents who represent writers were looking for, everyone was clamoring for more young adult books. And then I took a step back and tried to figure out, well, what kind of story would I want to tell in that vein? And I was a big fan of kind of shows that were probably a little too young for me at the time, but I loved them, whether it was, you know, The Vampire Diaries or Pretty Little Liars. And, I was watching and reading books, watching, you know, entertainment that was geared towards young adults and reading those novels as well. So it was a combination of interest and kind of marketing what I thought would, you know, work well for me as a debut writer. And those two came together in what was my first book, Becoming Jin.
So did you have a career as a journalist prior to writing fiction?
I worked for newspapers and magazines early on, and then I transitioned into trade publishing. So still journalism, but this was like high-tech trade publications.
So taking the leap to fiction, it's a big risk, you know, because those, I don't know if you were a freelancer or if you were on salary, but in any case, going to fiction usually involves a little more risk. Did you have any hesitation about that?
Absolutely. But I was in a very fortunate position. I had transitioned from the publication that I was working full-time for to be in the freelance capacity, partly because I wanted to explore some other opportunities. And I was lucky to have a partner who covered my healthcare, and that's not something that many writers, you know, have or have a bit of a safety net. Without that, it would have been very hard. Not that it couldn't have been done, as I know many, many writers with full-time demanding jobs who write, you know, on the side, whether it's weekends or nighttime. But I wanted a little bit more time to explore, so I basically went part-time. I went half-time to explore what else I might want to do, and I thought that writing was something I wanted to do, even though I wasn't one of those kids who always, I was always a big reader, but it wasn't always my dream to be a fiction author. I knew I wanted to be a writer, and that, you know, was in this place of the nonfiction world for a while. And then I said, you know, I really want to try my hand at fiction. I love to read. I think I'm a pretty good writer. Let me see what I can do here. And realized very quickly that what I had been doing and what I wanted to do were two very different things.
So what were some of the big differences for you? What were some of the things that surprised you?
I was quite surprised, as much as, you know, I was just a huge reader my whole life, and still am. And I thought I understood what a story was. And I had to, and I guess I just thought it's about writing. The writing is different because it's fiction versus nonfiction. And the biggest surprise to me was I had really no foundation in how you put a story together in terms of story structure, in terms of, you know, three act structure and understanding what scenes are and what scenes do and characters and goals and emotional journeys and tangible storylines, all of these things that are like now the backbone. I also now teach creative writing, and I'm very much steeped in all of this now, but I had no knowledge of all that. I just thought, oh, you know, you got this cool story idea and you just start writing it. And the truth is there is a lot of foundation before you get a story on a page. And I think that's actually sometimes not talked about enough. You know, we sometimes have this image of writers sitting at a typewriter and the, you know, creative genius and the muse comes, and that's lovely. And it does happen for some writers that way. But writing for most of us is a lot of time and a lot of work.
Well, how did you learn those things?
So I tried myself. I read a lot of craft books. There is too much information online if you Google this. and I did get to a place where I thought I could kind of put a story together. And I did. And then 3 years later, I finally had a draft that could go out there and could be queried. That book has not been published and probably won't be. I kind of treat that book as my own private MFA in writing, because I learned what to do and not to over the 3 years of writing that book. And then I took a writing class. And as much as I had been reading on my own and looking at craft articles and books, this instructor, everything he said and his approach just clicked in my brain in a way, or maybe it brought everything I had been reading together, which is, you know, is also definitely possible. And I implemented the things I was taught in that course, and it led to me writing Becoming Jin in 3 months versus the 3 years of the first book that I read.
So do you wish you would have taken that step earlier?
You know, I don't know, because as I said, I do think that I don't know if I would have been in a place to absorb it had I not gone through those 3 years of writing that first book. And, you know, yes, it's trial and error. Yes, maybe it's wasted time, although I think I always like to say no writing is wasted, because I think we're always learning. And so I don't know if I had straight out taken that course without more foundation, without the process of figuring out what that other book was and how to make that a book. I'm not sure I would have been ready to really absorb it.
Well, that's a good point. Sometimes, you know, I wonder about MFAs are very expensive and they're very time consuming, but I haven't yet talked to an author who did an MFA and said it and felt like it was a waste at all. You know?
I don't have one. I did not take one. I did, you know, have not had, gone for an MFA. So I don't know exactly the courses and what you're doing. I do have a good friend who's going through it. And I think she certainly loves it. And it holds such a great place, especially for the camaraderie you can develop with other writers. And I think that's a very important part of the, you know, publishing process as well, is finding other writers who you can share the experience with and learn from and use as critique partners and all of that, which can be very, very hard, especially outside of an environment of you're all in school to do the same thing.
And also it's someone holding you accountable as a writer, which it's sometimes hard to do on your own. And it gives you maybe the space to focus on it that if you try, I mean, and we certainly have spoken with a lot of authors on Writer's Voices who wrote their first book, sometimes their second, sometimes even their fifth book while having a day job. And so that's certainly a valid way to do it too. But to take the time, and it sounds like in a way you did do your own MFA, where you took the time set aside and to focus on writing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that there is great value in many ways that you can go about this, whether it's an MFA program, whether it's, like I said, I just took a course, at a writing center, and it's the writing center I now teach at it in Boston called Grub Street. And there are workshops through them and courses through them. And again, that accountability that you're talking about, you can get in a smaller program, especially as something to maybe give you the foundation and get you started. That, you know, maybe more financially viable and time commitment viable as well. So I do think there's lots of ways that you can go about getting a little bit of the, whether it's a little instruction plus that kind of camaraderie plus that accountability. I do think there are a lot of ways to do it. I did wind up very luckily, you know, early on in my process, you know, I took the one course, which is a short course. And then I found a couple of people who are still my, you know, good writing friends and critique partners to this day. And I was able to kind of get that experience early on and keep that with me through my writing career. But I do think those are great pieces to have.
Absolutely.
It's hard to do it alone.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices. Our guest today is Laurie Goldstein, and she is the author of the young adult novel Sources Say. Now, Laura, you talked about the things that surprised you moving from being a nonfiction and even technical writer, a journalist, to writing fiction. What are some of the things that you learned as a journalist that have served you well as a fiction writer?
Do I think the idea of being an efficient writer is something that comes from journalism? You can't write a 400-page article, although you can write a 400-page book. But so keeping that idea of efficiency in the story you're telling, that idea of being efficient in, as a whole, but also in the prose, kind of down specifically to, you know, using the best words that you can, words that are kind of more bang for your buck kind of thing, that kind of down to the prose level, I feel like I was taught as a journalist and can apply that to my fiction writing, as well as just, you know, some basic skills as part of my journalism career, as part of my nonfiction world. I was a writer, I did some graphic design, and I did a lot of copy editing. I kind of brought that skills to my books, which are, I'm happy to say I haven't lost those copy editing skills, as my editors say when it makes it to copy editing. They always say, these are the lightest copy edits you've ever seen. So I'm proud. I'm very proud of that.
I'm pretty sure you're not messing up your YOUR and YOU apostrophe R.
Exactly. And I think the other thing that you know, kind of more broadly that I learned as a journalist was, you will be, whether you're writing or editing stories in all sorts of areas. Yes, I did start the center, you know, in these high tech journals, so they were all, you know, under that veil of high tech stories. but they could be about anything. And part of what I had to do, especially then, was take some time and learn about it. So if they're talking about this aspect of coding and I want to make sure I can write this or edit this story well, I need to learn a little bit about that. Whatever story you're writing as a journalist, there's an element of researching, you know, statistics, experts you're going to interview, researching those experts. So then when you have the time to, when you are interviewing them, you're knowledgeable and can make sure that you're getting the information you need for your story. And I think all stories, even the most just contemporary realistic story, has an element of research to it. And those actually were tools that I learned as a journalist and kind of how to do that. And I bring that to every story I write, yeah, as a fiction writer.
Well, that was a very good answer to that question, I must say. So, Lori, why don't you read a little bit from Sources Say?
Okay, great. So the chapter, a part of the chapter I'm going to read is around page 90 of the book, chapter 10. And as I said, this is alternating points of views from sisters Kat and Angeline. And Kat is covering the student council election that her sister is running for president in that election. And the election, the campaigns of the student council candidates are thrown for a loop when this kind of sexist scandal hits the school. And this becomes the centerpiece of the candidates' campaigns. So this chapter is when that scandal comes to light and how Angeline uses that in her campaign or begins to realize it could be used as part of her campaign. So this is chapter 10, when Angeline stands up and out, 22 days to the election. Crackle, static, muffled voices, throat clearing, tap, tap, tap. Attention Acadia students, this is Principal Schwartz. By now, you're all aware that our school has experienced an unfortunate incident. We appreciate your understanding and discretion as the events of this morning remain under active investigation. Acadia Charter School maintains a strict sexual harassment policy. Pro or con, Maxine shouted beside Angeline from their table in the center of the cafeteria. What we have witnessed is not only disturbing, but shocking to myself and all of Acadia's dedicated teachers. You want shocking? Step inside any boys' bathroom any day of the week, Maxine bellowed. Angeline swatted her arm. You're making a scene. I'm well aware. Those photos plastered all over the school are real. I know. Taken at my party over the summer. I know. So the question is, why isn't I'm making a scene, but why aren't you? The perpetrator or perpetrators behind these so-called Frankengirls photos do a disservice to what we know is a decent and upstanding majority of our student body. Again, boys, Maxine started. Angeline elbowed her. We can't take sides. This isn't choosing blue or green eyeshadow. Never wearing blue eyeshadow is a total myth. It's really quite flattering. So long as you keep the rest of your makeup palette subtle, you can't be serious right now. What? The election's tomorrow. I can't risk offending voters. You're offending me right now. I'm in those pictures, and so are you. Rest assured, these Frankengirls will not be seen again. We have reported this transgression to the appropriate social media outlets, and seeing as how some of the body parts labeled belong to female students under the age of 18, any and all images and moving pictures will be taken down immediately. We would request that if you have posted an image of these Frankengirls, did he just use that word again? Maxine jolted out of her seat. Several other girls followed Maxine's lead, a few raising middle fingers toward the speaker in the ceiling. We would request that if you have posted any of these images on your social media accounts that you remove it yourself. We will not tolerate such a brazen disregard for the rules that govern this institution. For the rules, Maxine cried. That's what you're talking about? Rules? Rules? What about the girls? It's a joke, Josh Baker shouted. Oh, yeah? Chill, Tad said. It was a freaking pool party. You all chose to be in those bathing suits. High fives at his table, and Angeline rested her hand on Maxine's and squeezed. Misogynistic jerks, one girl cried. Boos and yeses erupted throughout the room. Maxine squeezed Angeline's hand back. I'm fine, but if you want to defend my honor, then get in the game. This is it. If you want to stand out, stand up and do what you're saying. Bring it. Angeline's heart beat in her throat. She had yet to prepare her primary speech, but everyone was here listening today. What should she say? Would being in the photos make people more or less likely to vote for her? She twirled a ring around her finger. Social media had taught her that backlash came like whiplash and was just as unpredictable. She scanned the room, lingering on Sammy, who stood under the football team's questionable "Sloths give a slow death" banner, and then on Kat, frantically scribbling in her notebook a couple of tables over. Angeline's eyes floated to the end of her own table where Leo sat, where she used to sit with him. His expression was neutral, but the tightness of his jaw sent Angeline's mind spinning. Was he upset about the Franken girls? Generally or specifically? Specifically related to her being a part of it? The former meant he was the boy she knew he was, the one she loved. The latter meant he might still love her back. Angeline inhaled a breath and propelled herself out of her chair. Franken girls. Here, unlike at home, she had one take. One. Franken girls, she said louder. The name's almost as demeaning as the images themselves, isn't it? Murmurs of offense filled from most of the female students, encouraging Angeline. This morning, the walls of our bathrooms and locker rooms were plastered with photocopied images of female students in our school, or should I say versions of female students in our school, three of them. Someone took the liberty of designing their perfect physical specimen. They pilfered photos, real photos, off social media and photoshopped them together like they were creating an avatar. A little of this, a little of that, and blah, a composite picture, a composite girl. Her phone buzzed with a notification. Someone had tagged her on Instagram. She made a show of shaking her head, masking her quick unlock and swipe. It was a pic of her from right then with a single hashtag female empowerment as the caption, posted by Natalie. Angeline lifted her head. Some of these girls, us, some of us, because I'm there too, wearing nothing but bikinis at a private party. Maybe we could live with that. Not like it, but live with it. But what did this person do? They labeled us, like we were meat. Shank, ribs, center cut, except it was torso Maxine Chen and right leg Natalie Goldberg. Maxine rapped on the tabletop. The adrenaline racing through Angeline's veins spurred her and she climbed up. Emmy stepped forward, but every pair of eyes was focused on Angeline and their phones. Notifications were popping up on all of Angeline's social media accounts. Screw the election. This will totally bump up her Ask an Angel YouTube subscribers, she thought. And I'll stop right there.
And that was Lori Goldstein reading from Sources Say. Now, one thing I noticed is that the parents, particularly Kat and Angeline's mother, who is obviously a very good mother, but she doesn't get very involved. And if this were happening, I think, to my teenage kids, I would be a little more proactive about it. But that's kind of the rule with YA fiction, isn't it?
You know, it is a, kind of, there's this little joke that goes around that, you know, all YA parents are deceased because we don't want them on the page that much. So it's an easier way to have them not in the book, which is sad. And I don't want to do that. So I'd like to have parents in the book. But yes, the idea is that teens should be learning to take responsibility for their actions and the consequences of those actions. And you know, teens make a lot of bad decisions, and teens in books make a lot of bad decisions, partly as a way to show growth and taking responsibility. So the involvement of parents too much takes away from kind of that overall, you know, message that we hope to be sending to teens as they read it. And you know, it's interesting because you often have kids. They don't want to read about parents either. You know, they want to read about the people that are their age on the page. So too many conversations, too much involvement from the parents. readers aren't as interested. The readers want to stay with the characters who are their age.
Right. And that's absolutely understandable. One of the, you know, you mentioned early on that this book, in addition to being about politics and social media and fake news and kind of current issues, it's also really about the sibling relationships. And to me, that was the saddest part, that these sisters had years of really anger at each other over a misunderstanding. And that's where I wish their mother had been a little more proactive.
Yes. And, you know, I think the part of that is the mother's own guilt in trying to make sure her girls have the best experience despite, you know, their father leaving them. And wasn't perhaps as attuned as she might have been to get involved and to step in between them and kind of hoping that this might be something that they would come to themselves. And I think the idea of that comes a little bit from, you know, you can tell your kids what to do and they'll go do the opposite. So maybe it's a little bit of that, you know, wanting that it to be their idea, wanting them to kind of come to it together makes it more meaningful, you know, in the end, if it's their, they're coming to it and they're realizing that this is a hole in their life. And it is sad that this misunderstanding put these girls onto opposite sides. And I think, you know, it's tapping into how real and raw things that maybe when you're an adult and it's your fifth time where there's a misunderstanding, or you know, the third time someone you trusted has betrayed you, or your 10th breakup versus your first, those emotions and the way you deal with it as a teen are very different than when you have the knowledge base of being an adult. So trying to tap back into that as a, you know, as an adult author of young adult characters is partly what you need to do writing these books, or hope to do when you're writing these kinds of books as well.
Do you have any young adult pre-readers that can let you know if you're accomplishing that?
You know, I don't have young adult readers, and most people who are writing this do not. And it's interesting because it is something sometimes my writer friends and I talk about of, you know, movies are very big on having focus groups, right? You can't do anything in a movie without having a group of people watch the movie and tell you what they like and don't like. And publishing is not that. And, you know, not at all. As we're writing these young adult books, they might not come out for, usually it's a 2-year time frame. We don't even use slang in young adult books because slang changes on a monthly basis, let alone a 2-year basis. And I do think that there are certainly young adult readers who would be such a great benefit to kind of, you know, that authenticity part of it. But it's also kind of this double-edged of like, you know, there's an industry of what young adult is and what the publisher is looking for and editors are looking for. And that's just not part of the process as we stand right now.
Well, that's interesting. And I didn't even think about the whole slang thing.
Yeah.
That's new to me. That's new to me. Now, I just had to ask this. The school mascot for the school that these girls are at is a sloth. Are there really any schools that would use a sloth as a mascot?
I don't want to say that there aren't, because I was listening to this podcast that was talking about a team using a flamingo as their mascot, a sports team, and kind of saying how silly that was because a flamingo is this pink, you know, pretty pink bird. And then there was this whole kind of uproar about that and how the flamingo is like one of the hardiest and strongest like birds out there. It can drink like boiling water. And so I don't want to miss the line, but the sloth and all of what a sloth might bring to the table.
Well, that's a very good point. Plus, sloths are kind of having a moment in terms of trending, aren't they?
Absolutely. You know, it's obviously important to say a kind of metaphor for you know, how the school has been in the involvement that students have had in the school, and even the involvement the administration has had in school a little bit while. So that's just a little bit of a fun aspect to add to the book.
In fact, I was shopping online today for ugly Christmas sweaters. Don't ask why. And I considered one with a sloth on it.
Yes. They're very photogenic.
So talking about, you know, the structure of your book. Now, there's we talked earlier about kind of the overall structure of fiction. But your book has some interesting sort of departures from a structure that you might have seen even 10 or 20 years ago, with this interspersed special report article and the text messages going back and forth. So, so tell me about the decision to incorporate those and, you know, how you did that.
So I was very lucky that my editor and my imprint at Penguin Razorbill was very open to what I hope to do with this book, because I didn't think I could write a book that is talking about social media, the pros and cons, that is talking about journalism without incorporating that on the page. I think it brings that to life and makes it feel much more realistic. That obviously on the technical side posed some challenges. They were great about getting, there's a couple of Instagram posts that they got an illustrator to, you know, to sketch the photo. There's campaign posters, and they got an illustrator to illustrate the campaign posters. Formatting text messages when you see your first pass and second pass pages. There is so much about, wait, we didn't format these text messages correctly, and you can go a lot of back and forth about that. So it is a bigger part of the process to incorporate these kind of extra pieces. But I really think for me, it was core to how I envisioned the story from the start. So it has social media posts, it has campaign posters, and it has articles from the rival newspaper of the Shrieking Violet, from the cast newspaper, the Red and Blue. And as you say, the book actually starts with a running story that is kind of told after the fact, after this election has happened, and kind of teases you throughout, kind of coming in, I think, in six parts to kind of fill in the pieces of what's happened during the campaign up until we hit the end of it. And that as a framing device is how I always envision starting the book, starting with this article that would tease you about all of these things kind of that have happened, and kind of lead you back to, wait, how did we get here and how did this start? So it was always my idea to have that framing device and have that come in to fill in the gaps. And I loved kind of putting those pieces together.
So did you write that first and then fill it in?
I write chronologically. Okay. So yeah, no, I didn't write that separately. I write from one to the next, but I am a big plotter. So I have an extensive scene by scene outline. So I knew, you know, when they were going to come in and what purpose they were serving, and when. I just didn't actually write those pieces, you know, as a whole beforehand, but I knew exactly what they were going to do and where they would show up.
So when you're doing that plotting and writing that outline, has the story concept, sort of the whole story arc, kind of appeared to you at once, or does it come as a process of doing that? And how much time do you take, days, weeks, months to do that before you start writing?
Well, I wish it came all at once, because it takes a lot longer than that. My method of plotting is I always start with the characters. And as I said, kind of early on, that, you know, this and all my books, I always want the characters to be the focus, and the characters are the ones driving the plot and not the other way around. So that means I need to know who my characters are, what they want in life, what they're willing to do to get it, what they're willing to sacrifice, kind of what's their emotional journey from start to finish, in addition to, you know, what are they doing tangibly in the plot. So a lot of what I'm going to do in terms of plotting, what people think of plotting, people always think of story, events, you know, those scenes. But the foundation for that is your characters and the journey they're going to go through on in the book. So once I feel like I have my characters set for those things, and I'll probably spend 2 to 3 weeks just thinking about my main characters in terms of those aspects before I do any other plotting. And once I feel like I have a sense of who they are and what they want, then I can sit down and figure out, okay, how are they going about achieving this goal? How is Angeline going about achieving this goal of becoming the student council president? How is Kat going about her goal of elevating her newspaper to the level that she can win an award with it? So I kind of take that and start figuring out the actual plot events. And I always do my plotting in terms of the big moments in the book. And so in a three-act structure, you have several key scenes that are biggies in the scene, and they come at percentages, 25%, 50%, 75%, and a climax. And so I always kind of start with those big scenes. And then once I have those on a trajectory that I think works, then I start filling in the smaller pieces.
Well, that's a very organized way to do it. I think that comes from your journalism background too. Yeah.
Yes, and maybe I'm a little type A, so that works for me too. But in terms of the length of time, you know, it really cuts down on the writing. Both for Stay and Scream Queens, I had to write. They were bought for contracts on proposal, and I had to write the full draft to get to my editors in 3 months. And there's no way I could do that without a detailed outline.
Wow. Now that sounds like that's a 40-hour a week job, at least.
That is probably a 60-hour a week job. Yes. I don't recommend it. I do teach and I do still do freelance editing, but I do not have an otherwise, part-time job that I have to clock in and out, although of course, obviously my teaching, I have to show up on time for my teaching. But otherwise, especially during those crazy 3 months, it's basically a 7-day-a-week job. I write 6 days a week, and on the seventh day, I read over what I've written to try to make sure that's all making sense before I dive into starting writing again on Monday. So I've done it twice. I really don't want to do it again.
No kidding.
But I learned a lot. I really did learn a lot.
So you mentioned that you teach at Grub Street, which is based in Boston. Are the classes all virtual now?
They have been virtual since mid-March. The couple of classes that I was teaching in person transitioned and finished online, and then the rest of them have been remote, and they will be at least until next summer.
Now, does that mean that anyone anywhere could sign up and take a class?
Absolutely, which is a huge benefit. There's not a lot of benefits to the pandemic, but this is a huge benefit, and it's been great. I've now, through all my classes, been able to have students from, all over the country, which has just been kind of nice. And the remote classes, I can say both as the instructor of them, have been going well. Grub Street has done a tremendous job on the format and the technology for it, and student experiences and asking them what's working, what's not, what they want to see, and they and us as instructors are constantly kind of adapting to make sure the experience is as good as it can be. And my students have said they're just as good, if not better, than the in-person classes. So I'm really thrilled with how they've all gone. And they're open to everybody across the country now.
And it looks like a new session will be starting in January, maybe, for most of these classes.
So they do kind of like a winter session, which is, January through, April or May, and then summer sessions and then fall sessions. So 3 times a year. But they also do, so they have many multi-week classes, 6, 8, 10 weeks. And then they also have some two-day classes, 2-week classes. Sometimes there's a 1-day class. So if someone's looking for just like a seminar on, something very specific, you don't have to necessarily be enrolled in a multi-week class. You can look for these kind of one seminar or 2 seminar classes on, kind of more narrow topics, and also be able to partake that way.
That's fantastic. And so if you want to find out more, it's grubstreet.org. And we are out of time. So Lori, we usually close with a quote which my mother finds when she's here, but since she's not here, I found one on journalism from Phil Graham, who was the co-owner of the Washington Post. I think his wife, Catherine Graham, is a little more famous, but anyway, he said, "Journalism is the first rough draft of history," which makes it pretty important.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. Very well said.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Lori.
Thank you for having me.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.